It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke.
So we're going to have a conversation that's a very black conversation about blackity blackness.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so how do you hope other KUOW listeners hear this?
I would say buckle up.
Mm.
You're going to be okay. Listen and learn.
That's Seattle poet Imani Sims and Carvel Wallace, hosted the podcast Closer Than They Appear, and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Imani wrote a poem inspired by one moment in the film Black Panther. She writes about the way that people of color are asked to perform race in white spaces, spaces like public radio. Carvel was in town last week for a conversation with artist Sandra Perry as part of the Seattle Art Museum's Figuring History exhibit, so we brought them together for a conversation about blackness within Seattle city limits. Here's the poem read by Seattle civic poet Anastasia Renee Tolbert. It's called Better Than Captivity.
What is it to know the cliff inside out? Rewound tapes, discard, unbow the knees, pray upright at the sun. Greet the open, surrender, inhale hummingbird hymns, play without apology. Loosen hips in red silk, we have become our ancestors' whisper against the constellation sky. Unleash God from ribs, spill out into today, a song locked on taste buds. Key the self into timeless abundance. Watch the spill on pavement spread, black within city limits.
Tell me about this cliff, to know the cliff inside and out. Why is that an image?
Why the cliff?
Why the cliff?
So I'm going to go all the way back to Black Panther. Killmonger and T'Challa are on the cliff, and T'Challa's letting Killmonger see the land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
the
right,
Wakanda sunset.
Yes.
Which he's never seen.
Yes. Yeah,
even though
and
it's his homeland.
So he's talking about, we can still bring you back and heal you. And Killmonger's like, why? So you can cage me, bury me with my ancestors. And it struck me that a black man would choose to die over being captive for the rest of his life. And I was like, whoa. So what is it to know that moment inside out? What is it to know that choice, to know that there are so many of our ancestors buried in the oceans who chose that version of freedom? And so I wanted to capture that image of choosing death over captivity immediately. And that was the image that I had when I wrote that first line.
Why did that image speak to you?
I think because I recognized the honor in dying over being kept a slave, being kept against my own will. I feel like at times I'm captive to my own skin. I'm seeing black first, and not a poet, not queer, not a woman. I am black above everything, every other identifier I have. And I think that in that moment, I knew how important it would be for me to die free. If things go haywire and we get bought out and they're enslaving black people again, I guarantee you, I bury me with my ancestors. I don't want to not live free. That doesn't sound appealing to me at all.
Well, in some ways, this goes back to even before the blank hits the fan and people are getting enslaved again, which is now a threat that we all, I mean, I have this theory that everyone wakes up thinking of the end of the world, thinking of the apocalypse, that's everyone just kind of, you know, I mean, we're like, oh, look, Walgreens is out of lotion. Also, will I need lotion if the apocalypse happens? You know, like that's kind of like what this time is about.
Yeah.
But presuming that society will go on in some iteration of itself, which who knows, this question of dying free really feels to me like it has to do more with the willingness,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the captivity that we talked about is what you talked about before, to be trapped inside the skin, mm-hmm. to be trapped in the way that people see you,
mm-hmm.
to be trapped in always having to live this black identity in a white space, and then mm-hmm. all the stuff that comes with it, to explain, to put up borders, to put up walls, to deal with microaggressions, to deal with macroaggressions and all that. And so we then are captive to that. And mm-hmm. so what is the alternative? And I know for me growing up, especially because I spent some years of my life as the only black person in an all-white small town in Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
in the 80s, 90s, when I was hitting puberty, it was not a good situation.
Yeah.
I can tell you that for sure. And what I learned about myself when I look back on that is that my fear of owning my blackness came with an existential threat.
Mm, mm-hmm.
That was never spoken. No classmate was ever like, look, if you're too black, we're going to kill you.
Right.
But that was felt.
Yeah.
That was enforced very slowly, but very seriously in every single context that I went through.
Yeah.
And then when I was an adult, and then the proof started showing up that was the case, the mm-hmm. visual proof, mm-hmm. starting with in the 90s with Amadou Diallo, with Patrick Dorsma, and then moving on. That was the existential threat.
Yeah.
And what I hear you talking about is the willingness to face that. I would rather be fully inhabited
mm-hmm.
and willing to die than to live in captivity around this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is such a provocative image.
Yeah.
To know the cliff inside and out.
Yeah.
Or inside out, is that actually what you write?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that. Killmonger has this argument that Wakanda
mm-hmm.
isn't as dope as Wakanda thinks it is mm-hmm. because the rest of the diaspora is suffering
mm-hmm.
and Wakanda was just there with all this crazy technology not helping.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, not only is Wakanda now like canceled, I'm also going to take over Wakanda and do what they should have did a long time ago
yes.
to stop this diaspora from suffering in the way it did. And the counter argument to that is that Wakanda's like, yeah, okay, we could have gone out and taken on the whole world because we would just be colonized as well.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about this question of, is it possible to attain individual freedom or individual liberation
mm-hmm.
in a context in which there's suffering across the diaspora, however you define that?
Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, that's the only liberation that we're afforded. I think that the system does a really great job of keeping us in check. And so I think that's why I use limits as a container for blackness, because I think that as long as blackness exists as a cultural other, we're still going to have to work within white limitations. And so the only real freedom we can ever really experience is our own definition of freedom, is liberating our own selves into a safer place. I think being free is really dependent on dismantling the system. Otherwise, we'll continue to be enslaved by capitalism and the patriarchy and whatever else the white colonizer can dream up to keep us in check with. The overarching powers have to change. The balance needs to shift in order for that to happen. So while I think it would be great if we had Wakandan technology, I'm not sure what we would do with it if we did have it. Do we then become the colonizer because we have the technology to do so?
Do you think it's possible for black people in America to have freedom and also for white people in America to have freedom?
No. No. White people are going to need their own little island.
Oh, shit.
Like, I think...
Oh my God.
I think
Yo. Okay.
I think there's so much PTSD around blackness and whiteness that we're going to need to be separate for a while, I think. And for a time, until they get used to not having the amount of privilege that they have, I think that violence would ensue. And I wouldn't.
Well, it already had. I mean, that is indeed where we're at. That is what
violence.
This is. This is a violent response to the very notion or idea of black folks gaining an increased measure of freedom or liberty.
Yes.
And that's enough to make people like take arms and take to the streets.
Yes. So we're going to have to exist in separate places. Historically, we have a really violent relationship with whiteness. The children of the diaspora have a really violent relationship with whiteness. They stole us. We were minding our own business in our own countries on one of the wealthiest continents in the world. And they just decided it was theirs, like 2-year-olds. We need to be separate for a while and like figure out what it is to be black without this structure of power over us, because then who do we become? What do we become, right? When we're so far detached from where our heartbeat came from, who do we become? Who are we?
Yeah.
And I know think we would need to figure that out first.
I'm Carvell Wallace, host of the podcast Closer Than They Appear and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. And I'm here with Seattle poet Imani Sims. I often wonder why it is that we do this. On a podcast I did last year for Al Jazeera, I interviewed a guy who was a Muslim doctor in a small town in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And he was the town physician, like this small town, and it was all good. And then November 9th, 2016 happened, mm-hmm. and he found out that half his county voted for the current president. And the next day, he was like, what is this? I'm like examining you and you're voting for, like, you know.
Yeah.
And so what he ended up doing was he realized that all these people had all these crazy misconceptions about Islam.
Wow.
And so he started going around to these small towns mm-hmm. and literally holding seminars to educate people about Islam.
Wow.
And I was like, but why? Like, why do you expose yourself to this? I mean, this is noble, but he walks into a room and someone's like, yes, I have a question. Aren't you the devil? You know what I mean? And I'm like, yo, why do you sign up for this?
Yeah.
And ever since then, I've been curious about this question of why do we communicate?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's a really big deal for me to show up as my full self. If they don't ever experience another Black person in their life, which is easy to do in mm-hmm. Seattle, mm-hmm. I wanted them to know that I am here. We exist.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to have a platform, I'm going to use it to like shift some things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why do we do anything?
Yeah.
It doesn't feel authentic for me to communicate my story and only tailor that to the Black community. I think that I would be doing a disservice if I didn't get white people together. Because, like...
Right. Is that exhausting?
Yes.
To have that work, last night, a conversation that came up between some people and I was the phrase hyper-visibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that you're super visible as a Black person in a white space, mm-hmm. and that means two things. One is that everyone sees you, and yet no one sees you.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
see what you represent. Mm-hmm. You become a very big projection screen mm-hmm. upon which they reflect whatever's in their brain. That's kind of like the Ralph Ellis Invisible Man idea.
Yes.
Tell me, is that exhausting to you? What does that feel like?
It is exhausting. I think a lot of times I feel like I'm the lone Black representative in a white space, and that I do then become whatever imaginings they have of a Black woman. And on top of that, I have mm-hmm. the audacity to be queer.
Queer, yeah.
So
right.
That literally explodes into a myriad of, you know, rainbows and mm-hmm. fists mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. whatever else they imagine mm-hmm. my culture is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm often tired. Which means I take a lot of naps.
You know, I was thinking, weirdly, this trip to Seattle, I've almost only talked to Black people, which is like
yes.
so bizarre. It's just a bizarre thing to have happened in Seattle. It's like weird, but that's the way it's unfolded. And it's yeah. been kind of amazing, right? And so I was thinking about how good that feels. Mm-hmm. And then I was immediately, because I also grew up around white people, the counter argument popped into my head that was like, well, that's segregation. And if you do that, I'm going to do that. I'm only going to be around white people, blah, blah, blah. And so, and I was like, I was thinking about this idea, how, you know, our public expression of love for Blackness, our public expression of the need to be around Black folks mm-hmm. has been in a lot of ways co-opted, misunderstood, maybe mm-hmm. perhaps willfully,
yes.
I would argue, misunderstood and then used to justify this kind of like advancing of an identity politics that is destructive. How do you respond to that idea that, mm-hmm. that well, if you're going to segregate, then we're going to segregate. And, mm-hmm. you know, I thought Martin Luther King said, see no color or whatever, you know,
yeah,
whatever people's response is.
I actually don't mind being in all Black spaces mm. and sort of avoiding white folks. Mm. I don't mind it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want the clarity around just because we are pro-Black also doesn't mean that we are anti-white.
I do notice that over the past however many years, mm-hmm. it feels to me that there has been a willful co-opting of identity politics to justify, at least linguistically, mm-hmm. this new formation of white racism, mm-hmm. this latest formation of white racism. I don't want to call it new. And I wonder what responsibility you feel like we as black people have to that. These people are out here marching in the streets and building up their whole shtick and who knows how far it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And we're like, white people, gather your people, like, come get your folks. Mm-hmm. But what if they don't?
Right. What happens when they don't gather their people?
And what is our responsibility there?
Yeah, I don't think that we are responsible. I think that's sort of the iteration of blackness that we need to be in. I'm sort of going way back to black nationalism, and like, if we can't exist within a nation that hates us, then we need to build our own nation. They don't have a choice at this point. Like, we have proven over and over that we can protest in the streets and still the power lies in the hands of white folks. So if you were an awake white person, I'm sure you have a racist auntie, uncle, somebody who's got privilege and power and can flex those muscles to make some change, because we ultimately, the system doesn't serve us. So our responsibility is to keep telling white people to get their people and keep living our best lives as best we can. And to nurture our community. We've got to have a safe place to go. And I think first and foremost, that's what we should be doing, is creating safe spaces for black people to go.
So you and I are having this conversation, but we're having it on NPR. We're
NPR.
Doing a performance of blackness in a white space.
Yes.
How do you navigate that? How do you square that circle?
I think I love that we've been able to be as black as we are in a very white space.
Yeah.
It's sort of like glitter. You just sprinkle a little bit and just deposit it in places just so they'll find it later.
Yeah.
I love that. It's like a sneak attack.
I love it. I'm so happy that I had an opportunity to talk with you.
It's been until late.
It's always wonderful to connect with other folks. And so thank you for coming out.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Appreciate it.
That was Carvel Wallace in conversation with Imani Sims. Carvel is the host of the podcast Closer Than They Appear, contributing writer to New York Times Magazine. Imani is a Seattle poet and educator, and she's a KUOW news poet. We invite Pacific Northwest poets to write an original piece inspired by a KUOW news story. I'm Bill Radke. That's our show today. The Record is produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jima Brenpong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, writer and humorist Gary Steingart. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.